Hello and welcome back to Core Ideas, the podcast interested in all things related to lake sediments and paleolimnology. My name is Adam Jaziorski, and as always, I'm here with my good friend, Josh Steenpunt.
Good evening, Adam. How are you?
I am doing pretty well, pretty well. We've got a milestone that we're reaching this evening.
Yes, indeed.
Because today's episode, well, I guess we've got two milestones. One, it is number 50, which is hard to believe.
It's very hard.
Our furious pace, we have still managed to hit 50 episodes of the show. And on top of that, it's going to conclude our current episode arc, Core Reading Lists.
That's right. This is the fifth? We did five in this arc?
I believe so. Slightly abbreviated arc. Slightly more work than we realized when we proposed it.
Yeah, for sure. And the uptake hasn't been amazing on them in comparison. The reward to effort is not great. So maybe we'll move on to something. Although one thing to say in our big, like year one, year two episodes, we did short little fractions. This is a proper episode, even though it's number 50. So it's not all that celebratory.
Yeah.
Don't turn it off now.
But yes, regular listeners will remember that this arc theme is developing introductory reading lists for a variety of paleolimnological topics. And given that it's the last one of the series, we thought it would make sense to combine it with the now sort of recent announcement that John Small, our PhD supervisor, was awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by the International Paleolimnology Association at their meeting, I guess not earlier this year, I guess late last year.
Late last year, yep.
And Josh was in attendance.
I was,
yes. And if you are a real regular listener, you may remember our discussion with John way back in episode 23. That was the final one of our History of Paleolimnology series, and how his career was intertwined with the acid rain debates and the establishment of paleolimnology as a quantitative science.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was a good meeting. I originally had intended to, take my recording stuff and do podcast content and get sound bites from everyone, and did none of that, including from John. I did ask him and then never followed up. So sorry about that, dear listeners. But it was a good meeting for all of the awards. That's always a highlight of the paleo meeting for me, is seeing the Lifetime Achievement Awards and the Service Awards and the Early Career Awards. And it was good to see that John got one of them. I think they are named in honor of Rick Batterby. It's the Rick Batterby Lifetime Achievement Award, even Rick Batterby's still around, but in honor of his contributions. And talking about all of John's makes sense. We can talk about some of the highlights of the Pearl group.
Yeah. And so I guess really, when we first tackled this, the question became of what kind of list to make. John is a prolific author, and there have been many publications from his lab over the past, I guess, 40-ish years now. Might be cracking.
40 years. Didn't he finish in 83 something, or start his position in 83? It's in that range. Definitely. Yeah. Pushing 40 years.
On the cusp, if not has passed that marker yet. Has taken his research in all sorts of directions over that time. Both Josh and I did our PhDs in the lab, so we've got lots of ties. I guess we'd be biased to the second half of that.
Yes, that's right.
Of that time period. The most obvious thing that we first looked at is, let's take a peek at his most cited list on Google Scholar. What would that list look like? And I'm going to rattle some of them off quickly.
Sure. Yes. Do you want to go through? So my first thing is, I was surprised how many of them were led by other people. So not only is John a prolific author, but he's a prolific collaborator, is the thing that jumped out at me. Why don't we just list them off, and then we can talk about it more.
Okay. So number one, I didn't keep track of the actual citation counts, but these are just what the order that they appear.
They're in the thousands for sure.
Reed et al. 2019 in Biological Reviews, Emerging Threats and Persistent Conservation Challenges for Freshwater Biodiversity. Small et al. 2005, Climate-Driven Regime Shifts in the Biological Communities of Arctic Lakes in PNAS. Kaufman et al. 2004, Holocene Thermal Maximum in the Western Arctic, 0 to 180 degrees west in Quaternary Science Reviews. Williamson et al. 2009 in Limnology and Oceanography, Lakes and Reservoirs are Sentinels, Integrators, and Regulators of Climate Change. And number five would be Dix et al. 1992 in Environmental Science Technology, Diatoms, Powerful Indicators of Environmental Change. And my initial reaction after pulling that list up was, that's not particularly fun.
Some great papers in there, no doubt.
Yeah, not knocking the papers of the science, but in terms of like talking about them in the abstract level, you know, it almost becomes a meta-analysis of meta-analyses.
Pretty much. Yeah, for sure. And pretty disparate. Like there's not really a theme that ties them together. It's a couple of Northern papers, a couple of... one method paper. I was actually a little surprised the Dixit paper was so high on the list. I mean, obviously an important one. Nothing really ties them together. So let's do something else.
Let's pick
five others. I mean, in some ways that's nice. We get to highlight five more because, you know, the small et al. PNAS paper probably would have made it onto a list. But by doing so, we can pick out another one because that one's pretty well known. And maybe we can think of in the list that we put together papers that we're particularly interested in, papers that highlight research that is unique to the Pearl group and really things that John's well known for.
There's that. And then also, I think there's an element of introducing the rule of cool. And that's right. It does not have to be a particularly highly cited paper as and to get onto this list and just more... in the realm of things that we think are cool and or neat and reflective of, you know, John and Pearl's work studying, I guess, Northern Pearlio.
Northern Pearlio. Love it. All right, Adam. Where would you like to start this list of Northern Pearlio highlights?
So I think in terms of my personal feelings about Pearl's greatest hits, I think the one that really stands out for me would be a science paper, so a high impact paper from 1994 by Douglas et al. So this is Marianne Douglas, who did her PhD with John many moons
ago. First cohort, yep.
One of the first group that was definitely, I didn't know, I've met her a couple times, don't know her particularly well, but definitely saw that picture in his office of that first cohort of PhD students jumping up steps of Grant Hall, walked past it many, many times. And the title of the paper is Marked Post-18th Century Environmental Change in High Arctic Ecosystems.
For sure. Yeah, I've read this paper many times. I remember reading it. I think I may have ended up reading it before I even started working for John, in his limnology course, it came up a couple of times. There's a lot of reasons that this paper could make it onto a reading list or a best of list, both of them. I think it's topical still, like the interpretations of it, very much a good example of early understanding of the impacts of climate change on lakes, how paleo can... be used to infer those changes, but also at the same time, the interpretations that are used to make those inferences still apply to northern paleolimnology types of climate reconstructions today. The diatom floristic changes, you could cite those. You probably would find more recent ones, but you could easily just cite this Douglas et al. Paper and be a good descriptor of the things that are being seen still across the circumpolar north on top of its significance.
Yeah. And just for those that not familiar, I'll be looking this up later on when we make a post about it in the show notes. So this is looking at paleolimnological data from three high Arctic ponds located on – Cape Herschel of Ellesmere Island, so very, very far north. You've never been there, have you?
I have
not. You're never part of that
group? Never been to Ellesmere Island, nope.
Yeah, so the Cape Herschel research was definitely one huge aspect of the work done at Pearl. And yes, showing the impacts of climate change way up in the high Arctic back in the early 90s, you know, in terms of, you know, in many ways, I imagine if you told them back then, you know, when the paper is being written in 1994, that whether or not climate change, that the climate change debate would still be raging in some level and would be viewed as ridiculous when they're showing evidence of it in like one of some of the most remote regions on the planet, dating back to the late 1800s.
Yeah, and I think they got pushback on the idea at that time from, you know, the initial, not initial climate debate and the skeptics and all of that, but it was really when it was ramping up. This is where evidence from all sorts of environments, all different indicators, observational, inferential, all of them started to accumulate and to really push that debate. And that's when the pushback started as well. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think they'd probably be horrified to think that we'd still be, you know, having this pseudo debate on the topic, at least a very loud debate on the topic 20, 30 years later.
Yep. Anyway, so yeah, no, it's a key one. I think I don't know when I would have read it first, but definitely early on, and as I became aware of John's research in paleolimnology in general.
And they went back to Cape Herschel
many times.
So many times, yeah. There's a lot of papers that came under Cape Herschel. I don't think it's the very first one, because he worked with Wes Blake from the GSC, Geological Survey of Canada, and others there, but it's the first big one from Cape Herschel, and there have been others since then. With primarily led by John and Marianne. So a good one to sort of summarize all of that Cape Herschel research, not summarize, to exemplify all of the Cape Herschel research. All right. That's one. Number two is one. That's a little bit of a bittersweet one to add to the list, by Bronwyn Keatley, who, and others who, Bronwyn recently passed away, unfortunately. The paper came out in 2008 in Arctic, Antarctic, and Alpine Research, and it's called Prolonged Ice Cover Dampens Diatom Community Responses to Recent Climate Change in High Arctic Lakes.
So yeah, so definitely inserting on a sad note in terms of Broman having passed on. But this one always stuck out. So this was came out shortly after I joined the lab, or at least was being worked on shortly after I joined the lab. And this one really jumped out at me as one of the cool kinds of studies that you can do in paleo. So it's basically a side-by-side comparison of lakes, where one is taking advantage of a natural experiment situation, where you have two lakes that in the high Arctic that are essentially side by side, but the key element is that there is a slight difference in whether one was in shade most of the time versus one was more open, and then using that as an experiment to compare the diatom floor between the two and over, you know, paleolimnological time, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I talk about this paper a lot for that exact reason, is that it's a great example of how you can test hypotheses with environmental data. You get the results that you expect, but it perfectly aligns with the understanding of the geographic setting that the lakes and therefore the sediment cores and the diatom assemblages existed in the real world, and how sensitive they are to climate change. And to environmental drivers broadly, but in this case, climate, where it is the primary driver of change. Yep. Yeah, exactly. Great paper. Talk about it a lot. And good to mention Bronwyn. I don't think we've mentioned that Bronwyn passed away on the podcast. The very first thing I ever did in paleolimnology as a summer student was weighing samples for and then digesting samples for diatoms for Bronwyn. Possibly these very ones, I don't know. But yeah, back in 2006.
Yeah, no, I think I've got a very key memory of Bronwyn is like one of the senior PhD students when I first joined the lab, and like within the first week or two, I walked up to her desk, and it was like an open shared office, knocking on it, and I just said to her, "Hi, Bronwyn, you got time? I got a dating question." And she just deadpan turned around to me and said, "I'm sorry, I'm engaged." That's yes, like one of my
exactly
first.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of it. Quiet, but damn funny. Yep. And as quick as you could imagine.
Okay. So moving on to paper number 3.
Flying through this list.
Yeah, it's a quick one. Settled on Blay et al. 2005, another science paper, Arctic seaboards transport marine-derived contaminants.
Very good. Yes. As we were thinking about this one, there's a few papers, again, from this project. These kind of like ones that summarize sort of the thrusts of the work that have been done in the north by Pearl and Pearl-aligned researchers, because Jules Blay, who is a professor at University of Ottawa, who postdoced with for a little while, and Jenny postdoced with for a little bit longer, is a paleolimnologist, but also an environmental chemist, toxicologist, all those things. And here we can see a good example of using paleo to reconstruct contaminant concentration. So there's that aspect, but also as a real interesting introduction to Cape Vera, this cool place on Devon Island, I think. And in addition, it ties in quite nicely to what we talked about last time with the coronamid paper, the very last of the coronamid oxygen reconstructions by Emily Stewart, which were from these ponds.
Yep. And again, this is another one looking at lakes, I guess, downstream of large bird colonies, in this case, northern fulmars, and looking at these nutrient-enriched lakes. And in this particular case, it wasn't just looking at the eutrophication type effects, but actually looking at the persistent organic pollutants that were being deposited or, I guess, concentrated within the lake due to the
bioaccumulation, biomagnification
from the all the guano flowing into the lake.
Crazy poop. Yeah. And actually, you know, there is a corresponding production diatom paper that Bronwyn Keatley also led, I believe, the Cape Vera stuff. And it's just a really interesting area. There's a great picture that I'm sure is available out there of John falling into one of these ponds when he was sampling it. And it's like falling into a pea soup. They're so green. So amazing photos, taken like high angle photos from the cliffs down onto these ponds. Another great example of paleo and experimental design, and just how setting up a really strong sampling protocol in order to test these specific hypotheses can give you amazing results.
Yeah, and another key element of showing, you know, anthropogenic impacts in these incredibly remote environments that, you know, if anywhere was going to be pristine, you would think it would be, you know, a tiny pond at, I don't even know what the latitude would be. All the way up there,
like north of 70.
Super high.
Yeah.
But yeah, so just like the 1994 science paper was showing, you know, climate change impacts in these ponds, and this one is showing ponds contaminated in things like DDT and other
non-natural contaminants, yeah,
that have been transported all the way up to like the ends of the earth, very literally. Mm-hmm.
Yep. and then transported up the ends of the earth, and then these birds feed quite high in the trophic level and poop at crazy numbers, crazy amounts into the lakes, and it ends up in the sediments. And they also, I mean, there's a science paper, as you know, Adam knows very well, and we've talked about it, is a short couple of pages at most, but there's a ton of data in there as well. There's the nitrogen isotope data to track a trophic level for the organism. So just a lot of information piled into a short four pager.
Absolutely. Paper number four.
Paper number four, a name that is familiar, and I believe, I didn't open up the author list to the second paper by Bronwyn, but I'd be shocked. Marianne Douglas, again, lead author on this. So she has been on all four of the papers. It's as much Marianne's list as it is John's, and that should make sense given that it's mostly Arctic-related stuff. But without further ado, Douglas et al., 2004, in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the USA, prehistoric Inuit whalers affected Arctic freshwater ecosystems. You'd think we were picking them based on the short titles, so they're all snappy, short ones. They're all in science, in PNAS.
I'm going for snappy for a reason, because, you know, this is like very much a diversity in terms of the topics. But where this one is cool is that it, instead of like modern impacts on northern lakes, it was like paleolimnology tying in with archaeological digs to find long-term impacts of prehistoric Inuit whalers, that there was still a legacy of impacts on some of these freshwater ponds, which is crazy when you think about it, because a couple hundred years later, the nutrient enrichment caused by pulling a whale ashore and butchering it, just close to a near pond, caused eutrophication that was still detectable. And I think still observable, just still, visually, to this day.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Sometimes 800 years later, depending on the age of the age of the site. These ones are for Somerset Island. They've worked on Thule and Dorset, which are paleo Eskimo group, which are even older sites elsewhere and since. Amazing for a whole range of reasons. I've seen John give lots of talks to lots of different audiences, and these slides, like the reconstructed house from the bones that has been built on Somerset by the Museum of Nature, and the impacts, and just the idea, the sheer concept of these Inuit hunters going out and slaughtering a bowhead whale and dragging it ashore, and the impact it had on the ecosystem is amazing.
Yeah, and it is something that, it's one of those things where a combination of the images, because the bones are still visible, that they would have used as like the...
wood?
Yeah, a wood equivalent as like a structural material in there. I don't know if though they would... Tents, homes, I'm not sure what...
Sure. What else? Dwellings, we'll call them dwellings.
Are still there. So you just have these large skeletons on the landscape, and then like a little, a very sort of like greenish, mossy, enriched area around the water body. And it's, reference my mom a fair bit on the podcast in the past as like my test layperson of like just running cool ideas by her in paleo. And this is the kind of thing that just would struck a chord from her. Immediately when you'd show her a picture or tell her a story, and it'd be just like, really? And it's like, yep, no, you can totally still see the evidence to this day. If you were able to get up there, you wouldn't have to do anything. You could just walk across the island and you would be able to see, oh yes, there was one, there was one, one.
Exactly. For sure. And I think that would be the case with a lot of people. And a good part of that is just how impoverished these sites are of nutrients normally, how cold it is, how short the growing season is, how limited the geology and the you know, how extensive the permafrost and just how significant a subsidy of nutrients a whale is. A bowhead whale is a very large organism. It's the longest lived mammal on Earth, I believe. They're the oldest mammals alive. They can live to be a couple hundred years old. And part of that, going back to the birds and the trophic levels, is, again, using similar methods. Nitrogen 15 as a marker of high trophic organisms, even higher in this case, because a bowhead whale is ancient and, you know, in age, feeds, even though it feeds on tiny little things in the ocean. And then this has a range of different methods in it, and further research on these sites that all of the authors were involved in just really rounds out this story.
All right.
That's it. Number five. What'll it be?
I think, again, in terms of, I guess, greatest hits, of not, maybe not necessarily be the right one, but just memorable papers. So we're going to, this is a deep cut, I guess would be one way to describe it.
You got to have one. There's always one on every album.
And that would be John's first paper.
Hey.
So Small, 1980. In the Canadian Journal of Botany, and the title is Fossil Cynorhacian Cyrus of... Oh my goodness, you're going to have to read this. This is your
Fossil Cynorhacian Chrysophysiae Scales in Lake Sediments, a New Group of Paleo Indicators.
So there we go. And this would be...
Way back.
Way back. But I think, you know, if you were passing this off to a prospective student interested in joining PEARL, or doing a paleolimnology project, you show all this other stuff of high Arctic research, long-term form, lots of science papers, PNAS papers, and then, but also throw in his very first paper as an indicator of like humble beginnings, because he would have still been a grad. This would have been his master's research, student. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. These lakes are less northern than the last ones. This is in Ontario. Lakes, looking at the impacts of development, road development, I believe, on on a couple of lakes, and comparing it to a control. But yeah, really, well, I mean, that's an important thing too, is that, you know, a lot of, I mean, he can be known for a lot of different things, known for the Arctic work, known for the acid rain work, but really something that John is very well known for is chrysophytes, and identifying chrysophytes as a commonly used paleolimnological indicator, both the scales, which is what this is about, but also the chrysophyte cysts, which we've talked about a little bit. So I think that's a good way to round it out and think about sort of the huge impact that John has had in a wide range of different aspects of paleolimnology.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think, like there's a very serious breadth to the amount of research that he's done. And there's a lot of it, and it can be a daunting, I mean, even 20 years ago, it was daunting to kind of like get a handle on the output of the lab. But now, you know, I think this would be a pretty good list of like, just to pass on to someone who's going to PEARL of like, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that they do there.
All right, there we go. We did it. There's number five.
Number five, and our last one of these lists. This is very much our list, and you may disagree, and that's fine. But these are the kind of things that we would send in a welcome, and I guess in this case, it's not a welcome to the project type of email, but a welcome to the lab email, or I'm thinking of contacting John to do some research, to do a master's kind of email.
One. Very good.
Especially in this one, again, because it was just a case of what jumped out at us as particularly cool slash neat, you could have a very large variety of different lists that you could pull out of that.
Definitely. It'd be a good starting place. You know, you could pick for each of those projects, as we've said, a different paper, two, three, to summarize it and to be the indicator list or indicator paper for the list. And you could also do a totally different set of northern ones. You could do a list of Perlio papers from out east, out west. Either way, lots of opportunity. But these are the ones that seemed to kind of speak to us when we were putting it together.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't know what his total is. It's something like 800-ish papers to choose from. I think he's got an H index of over 100. So, I mean, yeah. There's lots of choices to put on this list. And we just thought it was a neat thing to do, given his recent recognition at the IPA. And so as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to talk about in terms of the Northern Paleo section, the IPA meeting, etc.? Any other call-outs, shout-outs?
Nothing, you know, systematic. Nothing that I have, like, really well thought. It was a good meeting. It was good to see a bunch of other former Perlites, colleagues, that kind of thing. In addition, we mentioned John winning the Lifetime Achievement Award, Catherine Hargan, who we did graduate work with and I was a postdoc with, who's now a professor at Memorial University in Newfoundland, won the Early Career Award, one of two.
Congratulations. So
congrats to her. And they both gave, so John gave a talk in session, like a science talk, a 15-minute, and then did a little prospective thing when he got his award. Hargan did a plenary talk that was a little bit longer and was really cool about her work. A lot of the stuff she's been doing in Newfoundland related to seabirds again, and that's part of one of her background topics. But yeah, just really interesting. It was a good meeting for all of those different things. As was coming up with this list, you know, a little bit of pearl nostalgia is always fun. And we all like to engage in it every now and then.
Absolutely.
How about you? Anything else came to mind as we, I guess, wrap up this list, but all the reading lists for now?
Oh, I think there are a couple ones just on the pearl nostalgia level. I think, you know, when looking through the pearl list and then thinking about IPA awards and lifetime achievements, it's hard not to think about John Glue, who also got a Lifetime Achievement Award in the previous meeting, or
Service
two?
Award. He got the Service Award at two meetings before that, I think in Glasgow,
okay,
if I'm not mistaken.
And he passed away when, 2018?
18? Yeah, 2018, that sounds right. Or 2019. 2019, it was the spring of 2019. Nathan was born. We were driving when we got that email. You know, you shouldn't check your emails when you're driving, but I get them to my watch. So I was like, looked at my watch and I saw the email from John, and it was, you know, about John Glue passing away. And I was like, and we were driving back from St. Catharines. And that was a hard one to bear. We did all get the chance to get together at Queen's to celebrate him that spring, summer, yeah, before the pandemic. So that was good. And if anyone is interested in that, and I recorded the audio of all the speeches, and you can find them on YouTube.
And just for some background,
on my YouTube channel,
John Glue,
for some background,
was it the technical director at Pearl for many, yes, many years. And so he developed coring equipment. So many listeners may not necessarily know the name John Glue, but they may be familiar with the Glue Corer. He was great to have, you know, just a fixture of the lab for many, 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 many years. And
for sure. And not, and like best known for the core, but did all sorts of illustrations. So probably not for the chrysophyte paper that we just talked about, but many of John's books were illustrated exclusively or primarily by John Glue, in addition to, well, nearly every map in every paper before GIS came about in the lab. So,
yeah. And including illustrations, we've referred before to the Hutchison tree, and like John was like very much an, yes, illustrator. And so he did a small tree years ago. Basically just, that's up in John's office to this day, highlighting all the students that have come out of John's lab and gone on, and those have gone on in academia as well. You'd be a leaf, yeah, now, wouldn't you?
I'm a leaf on there, yeah. Mm-hmm. You too. I don't have any branches.
Okay, that's just PhDs. So you do not.
Yeah, yeah. It's just PhDs. So I guess because mine and Jenny are sort of intertwined, which is one of the fun things about it. Hopefully we don't get divorced because that would be awkward on the small tree. But so that was one of the, not very often would I say I have a good idea, that was something that I pushed pretty hard to bring about. And to collect the data for, and Emily Stewart actually helped way more even than I did in getting Jean-Claude, because I had the idea before I left to make one, and it wasn't the first person to come up with it, but just to push it forward. But the main reason that I think we decided to do it at that time was to have Jean-Claude draw it, because you never know, right? And then only a couple years later, unfortunately, we lost him. And so it shows all the PhD students up to whatever it was done in 2016, something like that.
I think it was given to John as a surprise at the second PALS that took place at Queen's, which would have been 2016.
And I can tell you, it was being worked on up until the night before. So it was accurate to that day. Thanks, Jean-Claude. Won't forget it. And actually, John did show that picture in his little acceptance address at the paleo meeting. So
very cool, very, very cool. Mm-hmm. All right then,
there we go. Where do we go next? What's the plan? We haven't really thought about what's next.
Not really thought about. We've slowed down. This has been I don't know if we were ambitious or it was just
it could be just bad luck, Christmas and the being away for the paleo meeting and you know,
illnesses and jobs and discovery grants and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, we'll have to think about what we're going to do for the next arc. Check the mailbag recently.
Let us know.
Yeah, let us know in the mailbag. There's nothing in the mailbag today. We got a very nice Twitter DM just telling us that they enjoy the show. We've not really been using Twitter very much, even for advertising show episodes, because I was not a heavy Twitter user beforehand. But the algorithm is definitely degrading and
very quickly.
I don't know. It might be time to start looking into getting a Mastodon handle, whatever that is.
Something.
And
something else.
And tooting.
Really all we do is pictures. Like we put up one picture, we could just put it on Instagram. Like it's one picture. We would do it every couple months. It'd be more Instagram posts than on my own like personal Instagram page. So maybe that's where I don't think we'll be on TikTok. Anyway, stay tuned to this space to hear if and or when the core ideas social media crops up. We do check it. We just don't actively engage with it. So we will see your messages, but we probably won't be replying to them significantly.
We'll just respond to them in audio form several months later.
Exactly. Yeah, you'd think it's, you know, like the idea that this came out 4 months after the paleo meeting is because we have this huge back catalog and we're preparing, that we're like 6 months ahead in terms of episodes. No, we're 6 months behind in terms of episodes. So what can you do? We're having fun with it still.
Yeah.
Something probably a little bit easier to prepare next, kind of reset, get us back into a groove of putting them out not every 6 weeks or 8 weeks, but every 4 weeks. And then maybe we'll go back to a small picture redux kind of thing and do some more methy stuff after that.
Yeah, I think it might be time to do something of like what we're both become intimately more familiar with over the course of this podcast run would be the money side of paleolimnology or research in general. I think we could probably do some interesting little screeds on that.
For sure. The stuff you don't think about, but will one day keep you up at night is what we can call it. We need to shorten the title, but you got an idea.
All right. Cool. All right. Well, once again, thanks for listening to Core Ideas, the Paleolimnology podcast. If you have a question or a comment or perhaps a suggestion for a future show, please send us a note.
Our email address is coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. That's probably the best way to get us. But you're also, as we just said, we're still on Twitter @coreideaspaleo. We read everything you send to us eventually.
And an archive of our past episodes and some of the show notes is maintained on our website at coreideas.ajezierowski.ca. The link is listed in our Twitter bio.
And if you are so inclined, you can give us a rating, leave us a review, or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, I think still, wherever you get your podcasts. Those interactions would be great, but to be honest, we don't care all that much because there's so few of them and we're just still doing this for fun.
And that's it for today. And although this was the last of our core reading list, we will be back soonish with a fresh arc related to paleolimnology, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy.